the U.S. policy and Europe's policy, which is now literally just U.S. policy at this point in terms of this economic warfare and everything else, it is having such a negative impact on the global economy, the world economy, and on just the capacity to breathe. I mean, that's how it feels. It feels like most of the global states just can't breathe under this arrangement anymore. And it doesn't matter if you're, I mean, it does matter, but the character of a certain society, let's say, as you were saying, Antigua, they're just because they have vested interests in the world financial system, close to the United States, maybe politically, doesn't mean that they're just going to do what Europe has done, which is shoot itself in the foot and because that has political consequences. A lot of even governments that are completely aligned with imperialism, because of so many reasons, neocolonialism, all of that, doesn't mean that they can deal with constant instability and expect to remain in power. And I think the multipolar world is bringing about a situation where countries don't need the United States, don't need Europe. They don't need to rely on them so much anymore. And it's causing a lot of friction. And I think it's weakening U.S. policy everywhere. And I think that's absolutely why we're seeing this contradiction.
I mean, it just, you know, any small, tiny bit of fake credibility that the European Union, these European NATO states, and the U.S. and Canada would have had before is going straight out the door. I was just laughing in a chat with some friends about, you know, this tweet that we saw that saying anti-Russian sanctions are working in Germany. Supermarket chain Rue warns only one critical item is allowed per shopper. The items are pasta, flour, and other groceries. There's a name for it, food rationing. And so, you know, it's really funny because then some UK person comes on here and says, it's a clever master plan to reverse and stop inflation. It was used in the Great Depression by Eisenhower. It works better than interest rate hikes that completely fail. They're saying, this white woman from the UK is saying that, you know, rationing these products, which are very normal products, is, you know, being done deliberately, and that it was used in the Great Depression by Eisenhower. My question is, did she make the same comment when people had to stand in lines for basic necessities in 2018 in Venezuela? Has she made the same comment about Cuba when there were shortages of some essential products in past years? She's saying that it's like a smart idea that they're rationing pasta, flour, and other basic groceries. And you look at the picture of the grocery shelf, and it's literally, you know, the most common grocery store items, such as the pasta brand Barilla. And we have that here. And guess what? Throughout this entire conflict and prior and after, the price of Barilla, unless something happens at the source, is not going to change because we haven't seen inflation here in Bolivia. And these things are just as available by quantity as they were before, by stock. Every store still has them. And it's at the same price as when I came here, 3 years ago. Wow. Nothing has changed. The price of bread hasn't changed. The price of chicken and meat is not supposed to change because there are government controls and because the government, through its various institutions, through its various ministries, is making sure that they supply the producers with the things they need, such as wheat, such as corn, maize, and other things in order to produce, you know, the things that they produce that are most consumed here in this country. The prices are not supposed to go up. Not only that, but the forward thinking of Bolivia's economist president and, you know, the rest of its government is actually benefiting countries of the region. We're benefiting because I'm not Bolivian, of course, I'm not the government or the producer, but, you know, they are producing fertilizer. They are going to supply fuel for countries like Argentina and Peru and even Brazil. And so, you know, these are the sorts of things that happen when these governments speak to one another, when the producers and the small farmers, the campesinos, and the different, you know, producers of quinoa, of coffee, you know, and so forth, you know, are there sitting at the table, quite literally, with the federal government, with the national government, and with the president, speaking about the fears they have, the concerns they have, the shortages that they foresee coming, and you know the fear they have that that could impact their ability to produce. They're resolving those things here at the table here in La Paz, and they're making sure that there's no supply chain interruptions like we see in the United States and other parts of the world. And not only that, I mean, there are several ideas for what, you know, Mercosur and SELAC is and can be, but, you know, these are, you know, mechanisms for not only, you know, regional integration, but, you know, economic cooperation and, you know, and trade areas, and as well as the Andean community. And so, you know, we have the capacity in the future, beyond what we do now, to get the supplies we need from our neighbors. We always say that Latin America and the Caribbean and Africa, the Global South, are resource-rich areas. We have everything we need to be able to survive. And we just need to find the ways to get the supplies we need from our own countries and produce them here, or get them from our neighbors and be able to share at fair prices for the producer, for the consumers. And we do not need to go overseas. The State Department right now has this campaign, and they're making graphics and videos, and they have talking points about the way in which Russia is denying 20 or 30% of the world, or whatever the hell, you know, access to wheat and anything else they produce, as if it's owed to the United States government, as if it's owed to the imperialists of the EU. It's absolutely not, first of all. And second of all, how funny and ironic that countries like Bolivia, that has historically been so deprived of its right to development and economic resources, and has been literally raped and robbed and everything else, and it's still struggling with development right now, has all of the resources that these other countries are crying about, and is able to share with its neighbors. Venezuela is sharing with its neighbors amid hurricane season, the start of hurricane season, and other environmental disasters. We're able to find ways to help one another through ALBA TCP, but also just through regular bilateral relations and cooperation. This is something that the EU and US and Canada do not understand, but it's being implemented here. So the more we can find ways to produce here, to share here, to find more efficient ways involving new technology transfer with countries like Iran and Russia and China, the better off we'll be. And Europe will look like a fucking dick. Like, they're just going to look absolutely stupid. They can sit there and keep talking about how Russia is denying them the right to Barilla pasta, but we still have pasta. We don't need Barilla either, because we're going to have our own factories here with our own high quality pasta.
Barilla, oh man, Barilla is such trash too. So yes, that's definitely a clarion call to continue that sovereign development. I mean, what you described, I mean, it's just the beauty of socialism. I mean, food is a commanding height of the economy, right? It's based in the land. It's a central need of a society. And you know, when you mentioned something like technology transfer, it made me think of China, because, as you said, China and Latin America are getting closer and closer. And a lot of the things that they're complaining about Latin America, they complain about China. Like China, yeah, China did demand technology transfer. Because what are you going to allow a foreign entity, foreign corporation, to invest in your country and not get anything out of it? Are you going to let them just exploit your country? No, a sovereign development is not based on allowing foreign investment to just take everything and you get nothing. No, technology transfer is a very low end demand, that's part of a fair business relationship, where it's like, yeah, you can have X market access, you can have XYZ what you need here. And what we're going to get back, if you have a strong government that has this kind of socialist orientation, we're going to learn from what you're doing. And then we're going to do it later on in order to build up and develop the country and have a diverse economy, one that can meet the needs of people. And I think what you describe, what Bolivia is doing, what you describe, Venezuela, you mentioned the low inflation there. I mean, it's incredible that a country that was having inflation at 10,000%, not more than 2 years, like 10,000%, 99% of revenue stripped from the country because of sanctions. And yet now the country, because of a socialist governance system, is able to adjust to that, is able to do what's best for both its the country and the region, to be able to lower inflation in that way. I think it's like less, it's like 1% right now amid this intense conflict where everything is going up. And as you described, Europe is being hit incredibly hard. And it seems like these imperialists, they cannot help but just try to explain it away that, oh yeah, food rationing, that's just a policy that we did back in the day to help stabilize things. It's like, no, the capitalists are just literally stealing and robbing from us right now. There is, as you demonstrate in Latin America, there with examples like Bolivia, there's no reason why this needs to happen. Like this does not need to be happening right now. And all of the various justifications are just putting wool over our eyes so we don't see that it is this imperialist, this capitalist system that's just stealing everything. And they're trying to steal everything from Latin America. And that's why there's such conflict there. Anyway, I'll stop. That's why there's such a conflict with what's going on there and why the United States is so hostile.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think another, going back to the reasons why some Caribbean heads of states and government decided to refrain from attending some of the Americas and are hesitant to get involved, you know, further with the OAS, which they are, you know, they continue to be members of the Organization of American States. The only countries that have really, you know, pulled out or are in the process of course, Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela. But, you know, some of the other, you know, reservations they have is, you know, the Caribbean and CARICOM have had, you know, I would say three major issues that they always talk about that are very important for the Global South. And, you know, we don't hear enough about them from the right-wing puppet governments of Latin America, non-Caribbean Latin America. One of those things, it goes without saying, is climate change. They speak about it in every single intervention, in every forum, internationally and in their own, you know, national press conferences and everything else. The way in which disproportionately climate change is having effects on the Caribbean region, especially on small countries that don't have a lot of resources, small economies, and the way in which, you know, we are impacted here, but, you know, the effects of climate change and everything, it does have a source. We do have people who can, countries that contribute more to environmental degradation, and that's, of course, the Global North and how they need to be held to account. And that includes, you know, that includes them taking further steps in countries like the United States to not only, you know, change their own policies and the policies that govern the multinationals there, but also, you know, contribute to the recovery efforts in the Global South. They've also talked about, you know, how difficult it is for small economies with the debt burden that they have. And they've also spoken, very importantly, about maintaining Latin America and the Caribbean as a zone of peace, as outlined by CELAC. And so, you know, this is one of the things that people are very concerned about. And the concern really intensified since 2018 with the, you know, this hybrid war on Venezuela. And, you know, this included all of these different threats from the Trump administration about a military option on the table against the president, against Venezuela. But of course, with the aims of getting rid of President Nicolas Maduro and his government. They made all sorts of threats, all sorts of comments. And of course, we know, you know, the whole story. They've planned all sorts of coup attempts, assassination attempts from Colombian territory with use of US and Colombian mercenaries and everything else. But the leaders of the Caribbean began realizing that they're increasing patrols under the guise of, you know, stopping narco activity in the Caribbean Sea, in the Atlantic. And, you know, what they're really just doing is further militarizing our region for no fucking reason. Why, what is happening in our region that they have to send more, you know, more warships, that they have to position themselves in all these different countries, increase the presence at their existing bases, carry out all these drills, these South Command drills that are being carried out jointly with other countries, as well as some of the military exercises, including European countries and their colonies and territories here in the Americas, are just an extension of NATO. And I think that people are really starting to see these governments, for example, Barbados, Mia Motley, Prime Minister there, and obviously the more outspoken ones, which have been the Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonzalez, the Prime Minister of Dominica, Roosevelt Skerrett, both of which were very good friends with Hugo Chavez. You know, these people have been alerting, you know, the rest of CARICOM and our region for a long time that we don't need that sort of militarization in our region. There's no reason to have that sort of hostility. Venezuela doesn't have its own hostility with Caribbean states. It might have a border dispute, a territorial dispute with Guyana, and things like that, but that is very specific. That needs to be held, you know, in an international court, or, you know, in dialogue between the two countries. But there's no reason to have a country which is the United States, that considers us to be their backyard, coming down here and positioning military all over. That's another reason why, you know, they are on alert, they're discussing this, and it's something that they agree with, you know, the rest of the region. Why are we having these drills? And so the Caribbean states are not non-NATO major allies. They haven't been deemed that. Argentina has, Colombia has, Brazil has a relationship, you know, with the United States. But these other countries have nothing to do with it, and they have no part in it. So I think that this is another thing that, you know, we'll see them continue to raise in international forums, and hopefully this week as well, for those that are participating in Biden's failed summit.